This is Solve It for Kids.
Hey, 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 my friends, you are looking so good. Welcome to Solve It for Kids, the podcast that gives kids and families a peek into the real world of scientists, engineers, aquanauts, and other experts as they solve problems in their jobs using curiosity, creativity, cooperation, and critical thinking. Please welcome to the show my partner in exploration, the dean of all things STEM and STEAM, Jennifer Swanson.
Hello, Jen.
Jennifer, what's going on?
Oh, not much, but we have a really special Solve It for Kids podcast today. I'm so excited.
I am loving this. This is so much fun. We're meeting so many fantastic guests. I spoke to an astronaut last week. That was so much fun. I'm really, really psyched. So let's spin the wheel, get right to it, and meet our guests.
What would you bring to an underwater spaceship?
What in the world is an underwater spaceship? I don't even know what that is. I can't imagine what you would need to bring to it.
Oh, it is exciting stuff we have here, Jed. Last week we had an astronaut. This week we have the amazing Fabien Cousteau on our podcast. He is aquanaut and ocean conservationist, and he's going to tell us all about what it would be like to live under the ocean.
Please welcome to the show, famed aquanaut and ocean conservationist, Fabien Cousteau.
Hey! Hey, everyone from underwater. I wish I was wearing my wetsuit.
I know. Wouldn't that be awesome? So we are thrilled, Solve It guests, to have Fabien today on our show because he is going to answer the question, what would you take to live in an underwater space station? Now, before we go there and answer that whole question, let's have Fabien start out by telling us a little bit about what he does and what is an underwater space station.
Well, first, a lot of good questions. I'm an ocean explorer and conservationist. I happen to be an aquanaut because an aquanaut is like a astronaut in space, just underwater. Same kind of training, same kind of extreme environment, et cetera, et cetera. We'll get into that. One of the things that I love doing is spending time underwater. And that's a luxury because if you've ever gone diving or if you ever thought of going diving, you know that you have to go back to the surface eventually. And that's the real bummer of it because you, just as things start getting interesting underwater, you're running low on time, you're running low on air, and that's it. You have to go back to the surface dwellers. So for me, to become a fish is like the biggest dream ever. And the best way to do that is, in my opinion, to be based out of an underwater house or habitat. And there are very few in history. My grandfather built some of the first ones in the 1960s. And, of course, the United States and other countries also followed suit and built some of their own. Today, there's only one left. Actually, it's right behind me, if you can see that photo right there. That's an underwater habitat. Actually, you can see the diver right there. And it's a really amazing, fun place. Now, it's a fun place, but it's not a big space. And if you've ever lived in a city, and if you imagine, say, your big brother or big sister living with their college friends, it's like a dorm room, right?
Oh, small. Very small.
50 people in the something the size of a school bus.
Oh, man.
And you have to live down there for days and weeks to do your science and your experiments and your filming. So it's kind of like a really tiny house, like that series on television. And, you know, your five other best friends are there with you for the entirety of the time.
They better be your best friends, right?
They will be by the end. There's a lot that goes into it. Obviously, there's a lot of training involved before you can do this. There's a lot of mental preparation because once you go down there, you can't come back up. You become a saturation diver, which means that you're trading the access to the surface world, the way a scuba diver can go back up to the surface. But in exchange, you get unprecedented access, meaning all out access to the bottom world, which is pretty awesome. And for me, that's really worth the trade-off. To be in a small space, you know, you're there to sleep, you're there to eat, but you're really there to go out into that ocean and really explore your neighborhood where all the cool critters are.
Wow, that sounds amazing. I'm still a little, I don't quite understand what it means to be a saturation diver. You explained really well the advantages when that happens, but what exactly does that mean?
It's a very good question. And so a saturation diver is, in some sense, a person does the opposite of what a scuba diver does. And by that I mean, in some sense, a scuba diver avoids decompression obligations or saturation in your body of nitrogen and other gases. When you're breathing air, there's other stuff in the air, including nitrogen, right? There's nitrogen, there's oxygen, there's trace gases. The longer you stay underwater and the deeper you are, the more those nitrogen bubbles get pushed into your tissues and into your bones and everything else. And so in order to come back up, you need those things to come out of your body in a safe way. If you go up too fast, it's like shaking a Coke bottle and opening it up, right? The Coke goes everywhere, the bubbles go crazy and everything else. And that's exactly what you're trying to avoid. Mm. And so as a scuba diver, you avoid those things by following the dive tables, by not going too deep for too long. With a saturation diver, we flip things on its head and we maximize our decompression obligations, which means that we would have to go really, really slowly back to the surface or sit in a decompression chamber for hours and sometimes days. But because we have maximized our obligations, that actually gives us that green card to stay down for a long, long period of time. I'm simplifying because there's a lot more involved, but essentially that's what it is.
So when you're saturation diving, you have more nitrogen in your blood normally and in your tissues than you would, is what you're saying. And that's okay, as long as you take precautions in how you enter back up to the surface, right?
Well, like most things, if you take the right precautions, then by and large, most situations are safe. And in terms of diving, and our world is a really interesting place, right? Compression of gases and pressures and things like that is pretty awesome.
Yes.
But in water, because water is 1,000 times denser than air, every 10 meters you go underwater is another atmosphere of pressure, right? So at the surface of the water, you have one atmosphere. At 10 meters or 33 feet, you have two atmospheres. At 20 meters, you have three atmospheres, and so on and so forth. And so very quickly, the gas bubbles that you're breathing in, right? The gas bubbles that are going into your right. system are getting compressed smaller and smaller and smaller because gas is compressible.
Yep.
And that sneaks into all sorts of nooks and crannies in your body. And it's pretty cool to look at it on a scientific level, but on a physiological level, you have to be careful because if you want to be safe, then you go up slowly and there are tables to follow and all that.
Right.
And that's not a problem. It's only when you go up fast that you start having the Coca-Cola problem. I hate to beat up on Coca-Cola, but whatever, soda problem.
Soda problem, got it.
Well, and that's an image that, because I don't want that happening in my body. I don't want any gas bubbles blowing up like a Coke in my body.
Well, and that's why the number one rule when you're learning to scuba dive is you don't hold your breath when you come back towards the surface.
Oh, right?
Because
okay.
the air expands in your lungs as well. And you don't want to hurt your lung tissue.
So when you're down there, okay, so first of all, tell us how long you have been down there. Because I know people have been in space for, 14 months? But we haven't been underwater for very long. How long have you been there?
Yeah, it's funny. you and I have done a comparison of astronauts and aquanauts in the past, and so that's always a really neat debate. In some ways, the ocean environment is even more extreme than space in that you have that variable pressure, which is something that, you always have to mitigate. And with regard to staying underwater in that, I'll call it a hostile environment, an alien environment for an extended period of time, it does very strange things to your body. It also does very strange things to your mind, just like in space when you're isolated. And so we haven't had the opportunity to go much more than a few days or a few weeks as a group of aquanauts. For the first time since my grandfather's days, a group of us was able to stay down for 31 days. Now, individuals, there's one individual, actually happens to be an astronaut as well, who stayed down for, I think it was 72 days or 69 days.
Oh, wow.
But that's because he refused to come back up. That's a U.S. Navy thing. I'm not getting into it. But pretty neat to know that he came back up safe. There were no long-term effects on your body. Psychologically, of course, you have to get adjusted again.
Well, you don't get to see the cool stuff outside and swim with the fish and all the animals. I think that would be the thing that I would miss the most.
My biggest bummer, the most depressing day of my mission, where my group and I of Aquanauts stayed for 31 days during Mission 31, my saddest day, was having to go back to the surface.
Yeah.
We had to trade that luxury of time underwater, decompress, as I was mentioning earlier, and then go back up to the surface to rejoin what really was a shock to us, because we had gotten so used to that underwater world, which was full of life and color and movement and everything else, just a really dynamic environment. And then we go up to the surface and we pierce that blue veneer back into relative emptiness. I mean, there was a sky, there were a couple of birds, and then there were a couple of human beings on a boat ready to pluck us out of the water. But compared to what was at the bottom, it was just shockingly different. And it makes me want to go back every time I have that conversation.
This is, I'm blown away, you know, because when I think about being underwater, it's like, yeah, you like underwater in the middle of nowhere, but it sounds like you're like in Life Central down in the bottom of the ocean. There's so much going on, and that we're in the middle of nowhere up here on the surface.
Relatively speaking, you're absolutely correct. We are essentially comparatively in a desert wasteland. I mean, our house was parked in a National Marine Sanctuary called Penn Camp State Park.
Oh, wow.
And it was a fireworks display of life. We were literally, the house was plopped in the middle of an underwater city. A coral reef is a city. You have your doctors, you have your restaurants, you have your hotels, you have all these things that are functioning just like a city. It just doesn't look like our cities. But if you sit there and observe, I mean, it's like watching a soap opera unfold in front of your eyes. It's just amazing.
That is so cool. Now, when you were down there, because you and I have talked about this, tell us some of the things you experienced. Like, didn't your sense of taste kind of go away?
And some of that stuff. Yeah.
Like, how did you feel while you were down there? Did you sleep okay? All that kind of stuff.
Well, you know, we didn't want to squander our time down there. So I'll answer that last part first. We dove 10 to 12 hours a day, each of us, to go out into that water column and maximize the opportunity. And by that, I mean that we'd go out and do scientific experiments, and we'd do filming and observation and so on and so forth. And we'd also do Skype in the classroom sessions, live from the bottom of the sea.
Oh,
I mean,
that's
really,
cool.
Really awesome. You know, it was such a unique experience. We had a hard time sleeping. But when we did sleep, we slept very, very deeply because of all that exhaustion. And some of the things that are different than on land are that your hair grows faster.
Really?
You know, if you have a bruise or something like that, it heals faster. If you have an infection, however, it also goes rampant much faster, so you have to get treated much more quickly. Your sense of taste goes dull. And, you know, I've got to say, I have a lot of respect for for astronauts, but now that I had done 31 days at the bottom of the sea eating astronaut food, I have even more respect for those astronauts because that stuff was awful. Freeze-dried food morning, noon, and evening. And it was a good thing that our sense of taste went dull because we had to eat three times as many calories as we do on land because of all the energy that we're burning.
Oh, wow.
To try and stay warm, to go out diving. We'd burn anywhere, depending on the person, 3 to 5 times as many calories.
Oh,
and so we'd be chugging down peanut M&Ms. We'd be doing, you know, all those packets of food. You can't keep fresh foods in a habitat at those pressures because fresh foods go bad very quickly.
Oh,
they oxidize.
Yeah.
3 times as much pressure, 3 times as much oxygen. 3 times as much oxygen, the oxidation goes much faster. So a head of lettuce would go bad in a day or two. Apple would go bad. As soon as you bit it, it would go bad in just an hour. I mean, it's crazy.
Wow. So Jed wants to go down because you said it grows your hair. Right?
I love that.
He was like, yeah, I'm good for that. I don't know if it makes it grow back, Jed.
Well, that would be a fantastic experiment, wouldn't it?
I'm willing to sacrifice to see if it works.
Hey, we told the astronauts that we would love to go to space. I don't know. I'm thinking Aquanauts. I think I would go down in Aquarius. Yeah, that would be amazing, wouldn't it?
Absolutely.
You know, you hit the nail right on the head. The anecdote is really cool between Aquanauts and astronauts. There are a lot of similarities. As a matter of fact, NASA astronauts train underwater before they go into space. So they have to become scuba divers before they become astronauts. So that's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. That's really cool, yeah.
Yeah. It seems like the more I learn about Aquanauts, and I just learned about Aquanauts a while ago when I met Jennifer for the first time, but it seems like there's so much to discover under the water. I think somebody explained to us that we've only explored about 5% of the ocean. That seems crazy to me.
Yes.
Isn't that mind-blowing?
Yes.
I mean, we've explored, take all of modern-day ocean exploration, last 100 years, including scuba diving and submersibles and ROVs and, you know, AUVs and all that stuff. We've explored less than 5% of our ocean world to date. If you take into account our world as a living space, the ocean, all 3.4 billion cubic kilometers of volume, represents over 99% of our world's living space, within which the vast majority of the biodiversity lives and thrives. So it's a wonderland of opportunity for exploration and discovery. And we're just now getting into the modern day ocean exploration. It's still very much in its nascent stage because, funding is always a problem. Technology is just now catching up. A lot of times we adapt technology that's built for land or for space exploration to explore underwater.
Right.
I believe that if we develop technology to explore underwater, we'll be much better equipped to go explore other places, including space and other planets.
So what I'm hearing is while you go down there because it's amazing, you're also going down there to study for science, to learn things about what you're seeing. And, you know, because, I mean, I would go down there and be like, wow, this is so cool. And while you do that, of course, but you're also down there making hypotheses. Like, we think this is what happens when, you know, like you just said, but then you learn something else, maybe.
And that's absolutely why we're doing it. As much as it's amazing and as much as I just love sitting there and just watching everything unfold in front of my eyes, and it's very easy to do because you go into this trance-like state like, I can't believe I'm doing this. this is just weird and awesome and amazing. I mean, you know, the more you would go down there, the more the animals of the reef, of that underwater city, would start accepting you as just a natural part of the life cycle, because they realize you're not aggressive, you're not going to eat them, you're not this foreign thing that comes down for 45 minutes and chases them around. You're there, and everything starts becoming normal. The Goliath grouper would come up, you know, fairly close to us. These are grouper. They're the largest grouper in the grouper family in the world. They get to be over 8 feet long and 800 pounds if you let them grow that big. And wow, they are just amazing, giant, phenomenal puppy dogs.
800-pound puppy dog, okay. I'll believe you.
They're so cool. I mean, they open their mouth wide enough to just swallow, you know, your head and your shoulders. But they're just gentle giants for as far as we're concerned. If you're a small fish, that's not true. But what's really cool is when you can observe them down there, if you have, you know, enough time to boom, which is when they bark and open their mouth, they boom. And that boom is like this pressure wave that comes out from that, from their snapping their jaw really quickly, that that creates this pressure wave that if you're close enough, it actually hurts your chest. It feels like you got punched in the chest.
Oh, my gosh.
That pressure wave is strong enough to stun their prey. And within a split second, they do that boom and they slurp up the prey and it's gone. I mean, it's down their gullet. If you do a slow motion video of this, which we had the opportunity to with this really cool piece of tech that we were testing out from MIT called the Edgertronic, that shoots 20,000 frames a second, right?
In this holy box, cow.
Wow.
You're able to see a cavitation bubble form right in front of their mouths that's hotter than the surface of the sun for just one split second.
Oh, my gosh.
Wow.
We'll have to see if you, is that video online somewhere that we could add that to our website?
We have some of the mantis shrimp, which is another cool animal that's really hard to film unless you have something like the Edgertronic, because mantis shrimp, just like its namesake, has these praying mantis arms that snap out and catch their prey just like a praying mantis on land. But you can't see that with the naked eye. So we had to shoot, I think it was 6,000 or 8,000 frames a second just to be able to see the biomechanics of it.
You know, you're talking about that grouper creating this bubble that's like hotter than the sun for a second. I'm imagining that, like, figuring out how that happens could really help us here on land with energy and stuff.
So that's a great, great point. And one of the main reasons why we were down there was, of course, to share what we were doing with the world live, because we had live cameras all over the place. But more importantly is the research. And there, we did a number of different kinds of research and leveraged as much time as we had down there on it. And biomechanics, as well as biochemistry, as well as, of course, marine biology and such, are some of the main focuses that we had. And sometimes you just stumble on behavior like what you're describing, what I described earlier with the Goliath grouper, which is fascinating and triggers ideas in your head for things just like energy. You're absolutely correct. Or how about using that cold water upwelling, you know, the differential in temperature from cold water to warm water to create energy?
Yep.
There are technologies out there now that we could adopt for renewable energies, things like OTEC, ocean thermal energy conversion, that could power the world nine times over without any significant environmental impact to our ocean.
Wow.
And we just need to be able to develop that on a scale that allows us to give that energy to the world. And we would be much better off as human beings if we did. And there's so many more discoveries down there. Imagine that right now the pharmaceutical industry, the biochemical industry, has only discovered about a dozen or so treatments that we use in hospitals and in pharmacies and all that, that are based on underwater resources. You know that cone snail I was telling you about earlier, mm-hmm, with the most venomous dart on the world, on the yes, planet? scientists have synthesized this, have replicated it, and are now, there's a treatment for chronically ill patients and for pain mitigation for a treatment that is 1,000 times more powerful, more effective than morphine, but without any of the side effects from that.
Oh, that's the best part, without any of the side effects. See? All of our listeners, this is what you want to be, Aquanauts, when you grow up, right?
Well,
study everything.
Oh, man, from the bacteria down there to the corals, to the sponges, to the cone snails, and the Goliath grouper, and the sharks, and there's so much that we just haven't yet even thought about that we could really, really discover. You could be the next, Curie, or the next, you might find the next cure to COVID-19.
Well, that's what the thing I'm hearing from you is that there's so much to do. I mean, our listeners who are 8, 9, and 10 years old right now can spend their entire lives and never discover all there is to learn from the ocean.
Mm, exactly.
There's so much there. It will take many generations for us to be able to learn from and extract the research and the technology and the information that we could really stand to benefit from. So there's a lot left for everyone out there to be able to discover. And whether it's from the microscopic to the macroscopic, there's so much there for everyone. And it's a wonderland. It's something to me that I grew up with that conjures up something that we use all the time at the Ocean Learning Center, which is a saying that my grandfather said to me when I was a kid. People protect what they love. They love what they understand, and they understand what they're taught. If we don't know anything about the ocean, how can we teach others about how beautiful, how valuable, how precious it is?